Hello, and welcome to an episode of Everything is Canon, the CineLinks podcast. Podcast where we discuss the latest books and novels with the people who wrote them. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. If you like that intro music, then you've got great taste. That's Sam Witwer in the Crash Tones. If you want to hear more of the Crash Tones, you can download their latest album, Revenge of the Crash Tones, on iTunes or visit samwitwer.com. Today on the show, we're talking to Christian Blauvelt, IndieWire editor, good friend, and longtime Star Wars author for DK Books. He's part of a small super team of authors who have combined their talents for this great new coffee table reference book, What to Watch When 1000 TV Shows for Every Mood and Moment, which strikes me as a perfect timing since we're all in a mood these days, and I don't know about you, but could use a distraction. The title says it all, and we go through the book talking about many of our own favorite TV shows over the years. Plus, as someone who covers the entertainment industry, we discuss a great many things, including the effect the pandemic is having on the industry as a whole. Since this is a reference book, no need for the usual spoiler alert. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. We've got a really fun one today because my friend is on the show. Christian Blauvelt is the managing editor at IndieWire. He has written extensively about Star Wars for just about every news outlet that exists and has written now countless Star Wars books for DK Books, including this year's Star Wars, Use the Force, Discover What It Takes to Be a Jedi, which came out in June. Here's the thing with Christian that I find very attractive. He's a huge cinephile, an expert on the subject, and even released a great book last year called Turner Classic Movies, Cinematic Cities, New York, The Big Apple on the Big Screen, which is great. I recommend it. And shows up on the TV occasionally to lend his expertise to a given film subject. And while we may have met through Star Wars, it's this shared love of film that I know will keep us together forever. Oddly enough, though, we're here to talk about TV in a new book called What to Watch When 1,000 TV Shows for Every Mood and Moment, which he co-authored with a group of equally talented folks. Hello, my friend. Welcome to the show.
Steve, it is such a pleasure to be here. And what a great intro. I got to tell you, a lot of professional TV news anchors could learn a thing or two from you and how you did that intro just now. That was very impressive.
If you haven't picked up by now, Christian and I are friends. I was very excited when this book, it's a weird one because I don't usually cover books like this, but when it came into my email from my friends at DK and, I was like, yeah, it sounds like a really cool, you know, like a really great, you know, shelf pull book, right? When you're just sitting around and great for trivia and talking things, and list books are always fun because they always create debate and even argument. And you remember the Hounds books, right? Of like the 1001 movies you must see before you die and all that
stuff.
Oh, I
sure do.
Yeah. So those are on my shelf. And so this, you know, I thought, oh, this will look great up there with those. And then when I saw who was one of the authors, I was like, bingo, got to get Christian on the show to talk about it. So I'm very happy that you're here to talk about this book. What I did was, it's a thick book. I guess it's a thick book. The print's really small. I just flipped through it because what I wanted to do was go through your section live in like a real-time reaction. So I haven't really looked at all your choices yet, so that'll be fun.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So we'll get to that. But let's get to some other stuff sort of first. And I would be remiss if I didn't bring this up because although I'm not a sports fan myself, I know you are, and I want to congratulate you.
Thank you.
And the Tampa sports franchises are having a pretty – in spite of the year that it's been, Tampa is thriving from an athletic standpoint, aren't they?
It's pretty extraordinary. I mean, I never dreamed that this would happen. And then it would be Tampa's luck to have all of our teams be doing so well, right? No one can actually see them play.
Right.
It's really too bad, especially, you know, with my beloved Rays. I mean, if there's one team that I love more than any, it's the Rays, our baseball team. And, you know, I was just 22 and right out of college when they made their previous World Series appearance. And that was a really remarkable time because, like, I had just started my career. I was working at Entertainment Weekly. And, you know, I was still so unformed in a sense. And I had, you know, so much to learn about this business, about publishing and journalism. And, you know, and so it was like me basically just, you know, watching a lot of those games then when the Rays were playing the Phillies with my best friend who was he had an apartment on the Upper West Side, and I would go to his place because he had a TV and I didn't, and would watch those games. And it was such a memory of a time when I really didn't know what was ahead, and certainly a lot of uncertainty was ahead. You know, I did hang on at Entertainment Weekly, but, you know, about a third of the staff was laid off right around that time to the economic collapse. And, Yeah, I mean, so it's just kind of amazing to think like 12 years have passed, and you know, I'm so much better established now. I'm 34 as opposed to 22, and wow, what a difference! What a difference that makes being 34 as opposed to 22.
That's a great story. And I love it when people are able to, you know, sort of reflect back on moments in their life when they really leaned on something, whether it was sports or, you know, film or music or whatever, art, whatever it is. And it, you know, it got them through a tough time or a lonely time or whatever time. Right. And I love that because that just means that, that property, whatever it is, again, whether it's the Tampa Rays or, Star Wars or whatever TV yeah. show, even that's like, that's your buddy for life now. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so true. You know? And I think this year people are really feeling that way more than ever.
Mm-hmm. You know? Oh yeah. Big time. Why? What's happened this year?
I know what happened. Exactly.
I don't think I've asked you this yet. Like we speak on and off sort of just on the socials and stuff, but I know you're down in Florida right now. Is that a permanent move or?
You know, it's hard to say really okay. at this point. I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, I'm still paying on my apartment in New York. So,
wow. Okay. Yeah.
You know, the idea was always to go back, but at this point, who knows? I mean, we're at the start of this horrible third surge really happening.
Yeah.
It's hard to say. I mean, it feels like the U.S. is, in its worst position yet in a sense for facing what all is ahead in terms of the winter months and people now heading indoors as it gets colder. And so there's going to be even less social distancing. And,
right.
Yeah. It's just
so in that, so sort of in that sense though, then wouldn't, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Cause, you know, a lot of my news is filtered to a certain degree as is most people's, wouldn't New York be safer for you?
Well,
than Florida in that sense.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Because New York has done an amazing job.
Yeah.
Containing the virus and flattening the curve. And I think it's really just about the best leadership we've seen in the country. Certainly leadership that we have not seen in Florida. That's the same. I would say we have the single worst governor out of all 50 states, like 50 out of 50. His name is Ron DeSantis.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I'm a huge U.S. politics guy, as you know. So trust me, I'm very aware of, well, that was going to be another question. Now I was also going to say not only safer from a pandemic standpoint, but it might be nice to be in a blue state.
He knows what the heck.
I know Florida's tight right now, but you know, I think.
On the other hand, that actually gave me a whole sense of purpose to,
sure.
to be here in Florida more than ever to help out with the Biden campaign.
Oh, right on. Right on.
You know, really make an impact here. I'm voting. I just voted here in Florida, actually. So,
okay.
You know, lend my support and help in a way that I think I could make more of a difference than.
Oh, good for you. Right on. That's glad to hear. Very quick story. I was actually in Manhattan in 2016 on election night. My wife and I were there to see a concert, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. And our hotel was across the street from a Hillary Clinton campaign, one of her sort of satellite offices or headquarters or whatever they call them. And so we were in New York on the night of the election and we were at the concert as the results are coming in. Everyone's on their phone. The band actually had to stop at one point and say, I know things are kind of sliding downhill right now, but let's try and just have a good time for an hour and then we'll, you know, deal with the results after. And Christian, I'm looking around this, it's a rock show. It's, and all you see is like people's faces lit up from their screens. And then at one point, you know, I couldn't help but look myself. And then you start to see like, you know, they lost, you know, Pennsylvania, then Michigan, then Wisconsin. And I look around and I start to see people cry. And it was a liberal crowd, obviously. And it was just, I'll never forget it. It was unbelievable. And just being in New York that weekend or that weekday, we were there for two nights, 3 days. I'll never forget it. And it was crazy. And I remember the next morning waking up and like going to get a bagel, of course, and coffee and just seeing like, I saw two women like crying and hugging each other. And like, it was fucking crazy, man. Anyways, politics.
That's amazing. Yeah. Yes. I mean, I remember my colleagues had a get together at I was working at the BBC at the time and they were watching the election returns live on the big TV in our office. It was like this huge, like wall to wall TV setup. And I saw some photos after the fact of the event. I was not there for that. And oh my God, just everyone looked so devastated. And
it was,
and people were then in Times Square gathering and were so devastated. And it was unreal. It was unlike, I mean, I'll never forget the way I felt that night.
I don't think anybody will. And, you know, and this one coming up in a couple of weeks is going to be just unbelievable. I suppose you, did you watch the debates last night?
I did. And, you know, I'm just so thankful that they're over more than anything.
I agree. I don't, there's so much I would change about these debates. I actually probably don't even know if I would have debates. I think I prefer the town hall format, but, you know, and I also don't understand why they can't have like a rolling, scrolling, you know, fact checker along the bottom of the screen. Because people are doing it in real time on Twitter anyways. Like, why can't they just hire some independent group that both sides agree on and have things just,
one side would not agree.
They wouldn't. It just seems so, I don't know. The whole thing is just so nuts to me. I guess. And another sort of baseball metaphor, I guess the tie goes the runner. In this instance, I think so. Biden did just enough to sort of just to keep, it seems like nothing will change from it, but anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that probably this one really didn't do all that much either way, but it's interesting because I guess going into all of these, I thought that maybe that would be the case for all of them, that they wouldn't have any real impact on the race because it seemed like everyone had chosen their candidate, was locked in.
I think they'd said that this is the least amount of undecided voters in a while. Yeah. So
that first debate actually did move the dial a bit and it caused Trump to shed even more support. So such
that was insane. That first one. And the other big thing from yesterday, of course, and have you seen Borat 2 yet? That's what everybody wants.
I have. And I can imagine you're covering it extensively on IndieFile.
It's funny, actually. My editor asked if I wanted to review, and I just said no. I was busy and stuff at the time. But I'm actually like huge. I'm not a huge fan of Borat, so I was just like, yeah, I'm not. I mean, it's always great to see people riff on, you know, the side that you are against. You know what I mean? So yeah. That's always fun, I guess. But I think I watched, while I was waiting for the debate to start, I think I watched about 20 minutes of it or so. So I haven't gotten to the Giuliani stuff yet, but probably I'll watch it probably tonight or tomorrow. But anyways, it's great timing. And it's always, I mean, I like Sacha Baron Cohen very much. Actually, I really like his like sort of humanitarian stuff that he does, which doesn't get as much press, but he seems like a genuinely good guy. So
yeah, he really is. I mean, he gave like $1 million to Syrian refugees a few years ago, and you know, he's very thoughtful about how he approaches all of this. I mean,
absolutely,
yes, and grotesque as a lot of his humor becomes, that there is some real thought to it. And I think this movie is interesting. I mean, I won't spoil anything here, but
yep.
I think it actually, you know, it may not be as funny as the first film because you know, the novelty is worn off to an extent, and that's even like part of the premise here is that, you know,
well, I got to the one scene where like people are recognizing him on the street.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But I will say that in terms of like a story and having an arc, it actually, I think, coheres even better than the first film. It really tells a very coherent story, and the ending, I swear, the last 5 or 10 minutes are my favorite part of the movie. It's really, really something. So okay. I hope everyone gets a kick out of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll definitely check it out tonight or tomorrow. One of the things, too, I want to talk to you about, you know, just the year in general and you know, the fact that it would have went straight to Amazon probably anyways because Amazon purchased it. But, you know, just the industry, how much has been affected this year. And you report on the industry. That is part of your job. So... you know, before we get to the sort of like the actual effect that's being had on the industry itself, how do you find personally being sort of like, you know, an editor for, you know, a site that covers pop culture, entertainment, the industry, all this stuff, when it's fairly obvious there's more important things going on in the world? How's that for you? How's that been for you this year? Sort of, you know, of course, it's always important. You know, we have to take time to enjoy the things we love, and that's what keeps us sane a lot of the times. But is there some days more difficult than others?
You know, most definitely. That's absolutely true. And I think there are times when it's important for us because we get you know, we're so busy every single second of the day trying to cover what's an extremely rapidly changing industry. You know, that it's important to step back and get some perspective on it at times, and realize that there are things bigger than movies and TV. But at the same time, I got to tell you, I mean, I've never been busier with my job as an entertainment journalist than I've been these past 7 or 8 months. And it's really because of the fact that movies and TV have been more important to people than ever before. And, you know, people need entertainment. They need diversion. They need distractions so much. And they need those meaningful TV shows and movies that also help you to get clarity on what's happening and put into focus what is happening in our reality, that don't just cause you to escape from reality, but cause you to kind of think about it more critically too.
Well, that's, that's the thing. I would think, you know, it'll be interesting to see, and I ask this about from authors all the time, and, you know, what stories are going to be born from 2020, like, what, you know, start, you know, next year, or the year after, what has this year inspired in people? You know, are we going to see, you know, are people going to lean towards sort of like, you know, happy comedy films, or are they going to lean dire, or are we going to see maybe more documentaries?
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see how the industry creatively responds to this year.
And then of course the industry itself is just changing before our eyes. I mean, movie theaters are closed.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Yeah. I want to get your take on what's happening in the industry. Film, we'll talk about film specifically, but this really does apply to everything. I mean, publishing certainly too is changing in a lot of ways. Not the same ways film is, but film specifically, what's your thoughts on what's going on with, you know, so many of these movies? And cause you're a huge cinephile, you go to film festivals every year, obviously not this year and maybe not next year. What's your, you know, with films, all these films being pushed out, movie houses closing, you know, this shift to streaming seems to be like on steroids now. And the most important question probably of like the whole industry, you know, what's your thoughts on the Snyder Cut? And I'm just joking.
But. Of course. It's astonishing to think that that's like being made right now. Or
They're filming new scenes.
They're filming new scenes. Yeah, they're spending $30 million on new scenes. It's extraordinary. And Jared Leto's Joker.
I don't understand. And I want to get your thoughts on this because I think I'm still on the fence, but I also think that it doesn't set a good precedent. What can happen in the future when if a film doesn't go the way an audience likes or the way the studio doesn't like.
No, it's absolutely true, because then will studios feel like now they have to go back and tweak it, you know, just to acquiesce to audience demand. I totally hear you on that. I guess this is a special case as well, because there was a family tragedy involved for Zack Snyder, and that was the main reason why he left the film. And so, you know, he didn't get to see his vision through. But, you know, no, I think that it is problematic. And I think it was Justin Bolger who tweeted, if you give a mouse a cookie, because it does feel like that, you know, if you just one little thing like this, and it's going to lead to something else. So, yeah, it's a worry. But for the industry in general, I mean, it's been incredible to see how quickly the pivot to streaming and video on demand has been. I mean, it isn't actually accurate to say that I haven't been to film festivals during the pandemic, because I technically have, but just virtually.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah. Same with conventions and stuff like that.
Too, right? The New York Film Festival did such an extraordinary job of migrating all of the films that they would have shown in theaters onto a platform where critics can watch them for 48 hours. And it was really extraordinary. The
whole thing. Yeah. And I get that, Christian, but it's not the same. I know you're the same way as me. Like a theater, like that's my church, right? Like, and
that's so funny. That's what I've always said. Yeah. That's
and awesome. Like there's a my town has a local independent theater in it. And it's for sale, and he can't keep up anymore. And the one in the next town over, Cineplex has stopped paying the lease on the building. This is a real thing that's happening, where I will have to drive over an hour to see a film in a theater if things keep going the way they're going. And that's insane to me. Like, you know what I mean?
It's true. What's the name of the town where you live? I'm really curious. I thought you lived in Toronto proper.
I did. I just live outside of Toronto. I live in a town called Southampton. I moved to the water. Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so interesting. There's been a little indie cinema that's opened in my town, St. Petersburg, Florida, during the pandemic. If you can believe, just opened like a month ago.
Okay.
I haven't been there yet because I haven't been to a movie in, you know, many, many months. And I don't think I'm quite ready for that yet, given everything. But at least like with like the Biden campaigning stuff, you know, I can do all that outside.
Sure.
You know, it's I'll be curious to like do a report on them or something about what's it like to actually start a new cinema during the pandemic, you know?
Yeah, because most people wouldn't believe you. And the thing is, like, with the schedule, the way it's just a friggin' jack in the box. Like, you know, how would you even know? Like that's the biggest issue, I think. Like, my theater in my town, it's for sale, but it is open.
Yeah.
So he's been showing classic films and stuff like that. And, and then whatever new release he could get, like, but the problem is the industry is destroying them because they, you know, they made him do an 8-week buy on Tenet with a 65% take. Like,
I know.
He was begging them to take it back. You know what I mean? At one point, he was only making like $100 a week off it. Like,
how interesting is that? Because people were still not ready to go to.
Right. Of course. You know, and everyone knew that except Warner Brothers, it seems, right? So I don't know. It's such a weird, I don't know. It scares me because we both love going to see a movie with an audience so much. And it's just, I just can't imagine life without it. And
I know. It's really hard. I mean, that's such an interesting case study right there though, about how the Tenet release, you know, it was not a good thing for theaters ultimately because people weren't ready to go back.
No, right.
And now, you know, the movie has opened, so it's out there. The spoilers are out there, everything. And it's not like they can really do that again. You know, it's not like they can try a re-release of it at some point. So I don't know. It's, you know, definitely, I mean, even Warner Brothers was scared off. I mean, they pushed back Dune, which I know you're very much looking forward to.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to that, yeah. Everything. I mean, now next year's loaded. I mean, if you're a movie fan, next year is going to be like the dream year. But what do you think about, you know, Mulan didn't really succeed? Not really. And do you think, it's probably not one reason, it usually never is, whether it's the political stuff that the star was going on about, whether it was the fact that Disney was sort of in cahoots with the government over there. The price at home was, it's 34 Canadian. What was it down there? $29.99 American, I think. Yeah. What do you think was the problem there? And then, you know, and then the film wasn't like the greatest version of Mulan.
Right. Yeah.
Also, it seemed to like sort of take out the things that people really loved about the first one, the songs and stuff like that. What was your take? So what do you think that says about, you know, the premium at home stuff?
You know, I don't think necessarily Mulan wasn't as successful as some people think it was. I think that it's just that fundamentally, streaming, I mean, premium VOD is not what he wants to do. They don't want to confuse the issue by like, you have to have a Disney Plus subscription and then you have to pay $30 on top of that. Ultimately, they don't want that. They just want to get...
It's a tax on top of a tax. Yeah.
They want to get as huge of an audience as their main subscriber base as possible.
Right.
And so, you know, the fact that then they would move like Soul to Disney Plus just for streaming without the markup suggests that like, okay, well, actually we might make more money just by getting some new subscribers here. And then not charging them the additional amount on top of that. So
right now, intent has a lot to do with it too, because they intended for Mulan to have a theatrical release, and that would reflect the production budget. Now going forward, if their intent is for a film to go streaming, they're obviously going to spend a lot less money on the production side and the marketing side.
Yeah, yeah.
So that may help in the long run, because that didn't help with Mulan because it did cost a lot of money, and for it to make its money back was an uphill battle no matter what. So
at least the one thing about the premium video on demand approach that they did, you know, with the markup on Disney Plus was that they got 100% of the take.
Right.
With theaters, they only get 50%. So
normally
that's still enough. You know, if a movie, you know, makes hundreds of millions of dollars, getting half of that is, that's great.
Yep.
that's what they need, you know, because they, I mean, I don't know, maybe people weren't as willing to pay the $30 one-time fee in order to watch it. I mean, it's hard to say because, I mean, anecdotally, what I heard is that, I mean, a lot of people did seem to watch it. Like, a lot of people who are not, like, super cinephiles, especially, mm-hmm. seem to watch it. So it may have been seen by a lot more people than would necessarily be, like, the target IndieWire audience. It's hard to know.
The strange thing about it is, you know, I listened to a ton of people talk about it, and the price point is always the part that came up first, right? Now, I said to me, like, the obvious, you know, zone buster is just invite 10 people over.
Right.
Or 5 or 4 even, or whatever. And for a family of 4, it's a great deal. And if you're that concerned about the price, yeah, invite a few friends over and watch it. Do a group watch, and then it's $5 each or whatever. I only get the price argument if you're like, I'm speaking about me. I prefer watching movies alone. So like $34 for a movie is a lot just for one person. I get that. Now, if it was Dune, of course, but I'm not dying to see a live action Mulan.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I haven't been waiting 44 years, you know, to see that movie. And, it, you know, so I'll, and especially knowing that it's going to be in the regular stream and the regular library at some point.
Yeah,
I'm,
yeah,
like you said, I'm already paying that service, so I'll just wait, right?
Yeah, no, and to be perfectly frank, that's what I did as well. I have not seen Mulan.
Yeah, neither have I. Yeah,
because I knew that. Oh well, it's going to be available just as a subscriber, which I already am, in December. So I'll just
wait. Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, that's the thing. It's, again, if it was Dune or you know, something else that, you know, you and I have been waiting for all our lives, that's obviously a $34, yeah, I'll pay 40. I'd pay 40 for Dune if they wanted to give it to me right now. You know what I mean? I would.
I think some movies, I mean, you might even be able to go higher than $30, you know, and that's what I think is really interesting. I mean, if other films try to experiment with this, you know.
Especially when it's not a rental, you get to keep it.
Exactly, yeah.
And you're on your library, right? That to me is like, yeah. That's the thing. It'll be interesting to see if they stay at that price point or if it does move at all based on what happened with Mulan. But
yeah.
Anyway, so the basic thing is, you know, one day I hope these theaters stay open, all of them, because I love them very much. And I'd be very interested to see if you do write something up on that theater in your town that's opening during a pandemic, because that's not the norm, as you know. So
It'd
be interesting to see, even if you don't do something formal on it, if you just talk to them, I'd be interested to know what the result of that conversation was.
Definitely. No, I'll keep you posted. I do think I want to write something about that, though.
Yeah. Very cool idea. I remember I talked to a record shop who opened during the pandemic, and he's like, well, I already had the lease. I had everything. He's like, I had no choice. What am I going to do? Just not open because, you know, he's like, it's just bad timing. He goes, we just got to muscle through. Right. So
yeah.
All right. Enough about that. What to watch when 1000 TV shows for every mood and moment. This book comes out November 10th. The presentation on this book is incredible. The binding is great. The page ribbon is a very nice touch. I love the stamp binding. I know you didn't have anything to do with any of this, but I just want to say how great this book is.
They did an amazing job.
It feels great. Like I'm holding it. The size, you know, just seems perfect weight, perfect dimensions. It's just a really nice book to have. And again, really get a kick out of having a page ribbon. You haven't seen those in a while. You don't see them too often.
I know. And certainly not with the DK book. I don't think I've ever seen a DK book before. So
let's do the history on it. How did this book come into your purview?
This actually came to me, believe it or not, I was at Sundance this January, which seems like a different world. And DK reached out to me about, you know, if I wanted to do something, you know, different from Star Wars. And they mentioned this idea, and I thought it was really interesting. And then they basically asked me, all right, so we've got like these 10 areas that we want you to explore or that we want to explore in the book, you know, and you see it's divided into sections. Like, yep. You want to keep your pulse racing, you have 3 generations on one sofa, you want to escape to a different time, you want a cozy night in, so on and so forth. So the one of those that ultimately that I suggested as one of my top three was you want to learn something new. And they were like, oh, do you want to do that one? I was like, yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I love being able to, you know, not just, you know, veg out and watch TV, but to really, you know, take something away from it too. And so
what were the other two options they gave you?
You know, I forget. It was, I think it was You Want to Escape to a Different Time.
Yep.
And also, I forget. I guess it was maybe You Want to Get Your Pulse Racing.
That okay. Okay. But which, either one of those would have spoke to your sci-fi fantasy background more than the one you went with. But
yeah, definitely.
Which is maybe why you didn't go with those, maybe because you're sort of, you're like, well, I mean, maybe your brain's like, well, I kind of do that, so let me try something else.
Yeah. I mean, I love challenging myself to do something new always. Yeah. And I think that, you know, in this case, this was also like, wow, you know, the research here can be so much fun as well, because even if I haven't seen some of these, well, then it's a great opportunity to watch them and then learn a little something new while I'm actually writing about it, you know?
Oh, so you hadn't, so they gave you the list of shows?
No, actually, oh, okay. So they did give me an initial list, but then I went through and tweaked it pretty considerably. I mean, actually, most of what you see here, not only have I watched everything in here now, but a lot of these are things that I suggested myself. So they gave me an initial list of like 95 suggestions, but I'd say that I swapped out like 2/3 of it easily with things that I thought were better or that I just really loved. Or, you know, whenever I do anything, even for DK, I really wanted to have my personal stamp, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you flip to like page 298 in this book, you've got this little documentary show called Great Old Amusement Parks. That's not something that they suggested to right. me, but that's something that I suggested because this is a great little film from this amazing documentarian based in Pittsburgh named Rick Seebach.
Okay.
Who is the inventor of this style called the scrapbook documentary, like making a whole film out of something very small, you know, that people wouldn't necessarily think is worthy of a documentary. Like he had this amazing 60-minute documentary that was a perpetual, like was perpetually broadcast on PBS in the U.S. on American Public Broadcasting called A Hot Dog Show. And it was just like a 60-minute documentary on hot dogs. And he had another one that was like an ice cream show that was about the history and origins of ice cream. And this one on Great Old Amusement Parks, I thought was so delightful and, you know, really is a fascinating look at the history of entertainment in the United States and what people did to just have a little bit of fun, a little bit of diversion. If they had some extra money, what would they spend it on? And that's the kind of thing like that would not have been on their list. So and all throughout this, I mean, like, you know, of course, like, you know, I'm a huge Anthony Bourdain fan, so I had to get him in here.
We'll go through it. We'll go through it.
Yeah.
Don't steal my thunder.
Okay. No,
I want to go through your section, like I said, because I purposely sort of held off on yours because I want to kind of go get a live reaction and ask about your choices. But, sure. You know, television in general, this is a great book, I think, for like 1,000 reasons. You know, TV has been around for so long. You know, somebody, you know, born in the last 5-10 years would have not have heard of many of these shows, but for us older folks, you know, we know so many of these TV shows. And I was just curious about sort of like, what are your, you know, TV watching habits these days? Like, are you choosing cable prime time shows? You bother with those anymore? Are you just whatever streaming? What's your deal?
You know, it's funny. Lately, I've been so busy. I really mean it. Like, even though there are no movies playing in theaters right now, IndieWire has never been busier than we've been these past few months. So I literally haven't been able to watch that much. Mm-hmm. A lot of what I watch are screeners of movies that I just watch on my laptop. Yep. In terms of shows right now, wow. I mean, I'm watching Star Trek Discovery. which I recap as well for IndieWire.
Okay. You'll watch The Mandalorian, of course, and you're going to want like that stuff. Like, yeah. You know, and I'm sure you watched like, you know, The Witcher and these types of things that come out on Netflix.
No, I've never watched The Witcher, believe it or not.
Okay. It's okay. You know, I find my, you know, when I, it's funny how Netflix, I prefer their animated stuff more than their live action stuff. But
yeah, it's a really funny thing. A lot of the Netflix stuff doesn't really do it for me, I have to say.
Yeah. Like I love I love the Castlevania series on Netflix.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Of course, Avatar. Yeah. The live action stuff doesn't always do it for me either for Netflix, but you know, that like these things, you know, like The Boys and Umbrella, like Prime and, you know, Apple TV now. And it's just, I have so many streaming services, Christian. I don't like, it's insane. I don't even get it. It's just, looking, this book made me sort of like nostalgic, right? For like the days when I was growing up, and it just, you know, it felt easier to watch TV because it was easier to watch TV.
Sure. I mean, you really do need a book like this.
Yeah. And like,
the sense of what you might watch next, you know, I mean,
and,
and it's like, it's so overwhelming. And I would say though, that honestly, I am at the point though, officially, where most of the things I do watch are really not long form drama or comedy series, but really are more like one-off documentary programs like that are featured in my section here. Because actually one thing I've just loved recently is the second season of Now Hear This, which I do in here.
Yep.
They just debuted that on PBS a few weeks ago, and it's like each episode is devoted to a different classical composer.
Right on.
And, you know, here's like why Haydn is important, why Schubert is important.
Okay.
Really interesting. And it's a lot of those kind of things. I love a lot of shows that you can just watch in like an hour and then that's it. Like I don't, self-contained. And yeah, my actual patience for even miniseries is very limited these days.
I really like the, you know, the get in, get out format, right? Like I like that The Mandalorian is in 22 episodes. I love that The Watchmen was only a handful of episodes. I love that Lovecraft Country was only 8 episodes. You know, as much as you want more, it's really great to leave wanting more. You know, I love anthologies. I can't watch, like the days of, you know, 10 seasons, like, some like Grey's Anatomy is still, I never watched Grey's Anatomy, but it's still on TV. It's like 20 years. Like there's no way I'm watching a show that long. It's funny though. When I grabbed this book, the first thing I did was flip to the index because like my, you know, how I decide if this book is legit or not is if somebody mentioned Northern Exposure.
Oh, let's see. Is it in here?
It is in there.
Good.
It was in there. I can't remember what section it was in.
Yeah, Northern Exposure, I've never seen it, believe it or not. And
okay.
That feels like a show that I would really like.
It's so, you know,
but it has a lot of atmosphere, right?
It's got a ton of atmosphere. It's got a surprising amount of heart. And there's a bit of like, you know, because of where it takes place, of course, you know, there's that sense of like, you know, indigenous mysticism and there's magic in the air and, it was an own voices show in a lot of ways. And, you know, as much as, you know, obviously, you know, we lean fantasy and speculative and sci-fi, but that's just one of those TV shows that I watched when it came out and loved it, fell in love with the characters and, loved it. And it's always like this thing, whereas like anytime it's not even just to like decide if this book is any good or not, if Northern Exposure is in it, it's just to be like, yes, somebody else remembers that show.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's funny. That is a show that I've always wanted to check out. It's never really been in syndication here in the States all that much, but
no, I know. Yeah,
I just feel like
I think you'd like it. I really do think you'd like it. It's in the you need a feel good moment section, so that's I guess as good as any. But it is. It's like I said. There's a bit of mysticism to it, and it's deep, and there's some really really honest good conversations, and. And that cast all went on to do, you know, more or less good things. So, yeah, anyways, I recommend it. But anyways, let's go. You want to learn something new. Chef's kiss to your, you may find your IQ going up and not just when watching QI line. So that's a
Oh, there you go. Thank you. I remember writing that. That was, you know, all of this I got done shortly before the pandemic really got up and running. I mean, I wrote this very quickly, this section.
Okay.
Quite a lot of, there are actually like 22,000 words, I think, in here, just in my section alone.
Okay.
It's like page 287 to, what is it, 332, I think.
I thought you were going to say just in the Crown section alone, there's 22,000
words. we have a good bit on the Crown, though. Which yeah.
So you start off with the Crown. What was the casting announcement they just made?
Well, Elizabeth Debicki is going to be Diana. And then they just cast
someone. Who was the male? Who did they just cast as
Dominic West.
Dominic West, that was it. Yeah. He's great.
Yeah.
The Crown, a massively popular show that I've never watched.
You know, it's funny. I got into it largely because of my mom. She's such a huge fan. And it's funny that I hadn't really checked it out before that. Again, it's just like trying to find the time for these things, I guess, because I actually had seen the play that the show was based on, or that sort of originated the idea for the show. It was this great play by Peter Morgan called The Audience, where Helen Mirren played the Queen over 50 years.
Mm.
And it's about her interacting with, you know, all, I guess, 10 or 11 at that point of the prime ministers that she's had. Now she's up to 12, but... Was that
had anything to do with the movie The Queen that she was in?
Yes.
Okay.
It was the same writer. So okay. Peter Morgan wrote The Queen, and then she basically reprised the role for this take that was like, well, what if we now look at her life in total?
Okay. You
know, look at it from when she first became queen with Winston Churchill as prime minister and, you know, the early 50s and, you know, he being kind of a mentor to her all the way up. And I think at that point they went up through Gordon Brown.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, it was a wonderful, wonderful play. It was about 3 hours, 3.5 hours, I think, and really moving. And I saw this in 2013. I didn't see it in person. I saw a live stream of it at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, a live stream of a production that was happening at that moment in London. And I thought it was so great. And that it was like, wow, this is one of the best plays I've ever seen. I'm not even seeing it actually in person.
Right.
And then it became the show. And, you know, Morgan is just an extremely gifted writer, I have to say, extremely gifted. And this show, of course, The Crown is like the most expensive TV series of all time. Each episode is like $5 or $6 million to produce. It's incredible.
What do you mean? Like on that in London or in, not in not. Of all time.
No, of all time. Each season has been like over $100 million to produce.
It's, didn't they spend like $10 million per like Mandalorian, and didn't Lord or Game of Thrones cost more than that?
Game of Thrones.
That can't be right, Christian. That's gotta be, that can't be the most expensive.
No, no, it's really true. I mean, The Crown has just an astounding budget.
I will not debate you on that point, but I think The Mandalorian was like $10 million per.
Maybe, yeah. But Mandalorian was also only an 8-episode first season, and each episode.
Well, but that doesn't change the cost per episode, though.
But each episode is also only like a half hour to 40 minutes, you know, tops. These are like four.
I think one episode was actually 10 minutes, but.
And it's definitely up there. I mean,
yeah.
In a little, they haven't said flat out exactly how much they're spending on Mandalorian, but I remember they've also had a lot of cost saving. Aspects to their production, such as the volume and
for sure they're using that, some of that on the Batman film too, right?
Yeah, and they're going to be using it on the Star Trek shows going forward here.
Oh, cool, right on. So yeah, The Crown, you know, it's so funny. Yeah, it's probably too late now, I'll never watch it, too many seasons in now, but great. I mean, the cast is incredible. Like, who doesn't love Claire Foy and Olivia Colman and Matt Smith and all the rest? So great cast. It's one of those great, awesome shows that I'll just never see. It's too bad. But I really love your second choice, Chernobyl. I loved that series, that miniseries.
Yeah.
Wasn't that the cast? Oh, so great in it. And you've seen it, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I got anxiety watching that show.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's so timely because I think at the time people likened it to climate change in a way, in terms of like
a
government just... you know, utterly failing its people in terms of dealing with this environmental disaster.
And these,
of course, now in light of the pandemic, I mean, my God, everyone's saying like Craig Mazin should do a Chernobyl, but about COVID, you know?
Right. Yeah. But and this, you know, I love the cast is they're all sort of bit players that normally pop up in things, but you don't remember their names, or you're like, oh, I know that guy, but you don't know his name. Like Jared Harris, the star of this show, and Stellan Skarsgård, who of course is in Dune, and he's been in and of you know all the Marvel MCU people would probably know him too. But Emily Watson was so great, and what a and I can't remember the actor's name who played sort of like the shift manager, but unbelievable. But that's I love that series, and I know it did well, did very well for everyone involved. Gianna, the assassination of Gianna Versace, great. That was great. Fosse Verdon, great. Sam Rockwell can do no wrong in my books. At some point, what did you had you seen these the ones we've mentioned so far before when you sat down? Okay, you had. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's so funny. I showed Chernobyl to my mom, I think about a year ago, and it was like so intense that she cut out after the first episode. It was.
During the first episode, I at one point had to get up and leave the room because I was getting so much anxiety because as the amount of bad decisions pile up, it's just, you just can't believe, you know, you don't, the inept, you know, the ineptness on display, right, is just unbelievable. I mean, it's easy to say that now, of course, looking back, but just insane. It just, anyway, just something that could have been prevented. Such an awful, and the fact that it's still affecting so much, so many decades later. I, Claudius, Jesus of Nazareth, Medici, Masters of Florence. These are all, like, I haven't seen any of those.
Well, Medici Masters of Florence is an ongoing series. I think
it's, okay.
Like, it's fifth season now. The others are just mini series.
Okay. John Adams, I did see. I thought that was really great.
Yeah.
I saw Bobby Kennedy. I did not see Bolivar.
Bolivar is a telenovela, actually.
Okay. Okay.
So that means you have like 50 episodes a season, and it's really in depth. And you know, I wanted to bring as much diversity to this as possible in terms of national origin.
Yeah.
You know, that seemed like a natural fit. It's really, I mean, an extraordinary life Simone Bolivar had. And, you know, to be able to, like, turn it into this long-form entertainment that's just so epic is a pretty incredible thing.
It's too bad, like, it takes a lot of investment, you know, to watch a TV series just because it's the length of it, the sheer length of some of these, you know, run multiple seasons in some cases. It, you know, cause this would be a great like checklist book, right? It's not like a movie you can pound out an hour and a half, 2 hours or a book. Right. So that's the only, you know, cause it's like all these things you're going to sell me on so many of these shows that I'm really truthfully never going to watch them. Cause just the investment in time is just too much at this point. Yeah. But, you know, it's great. I love it. Does, like you said, you're covering such a wide gambit of just nationalities, even, and that's a really great thing for people to be able to look up in an instant and be like, you know, I want to expand my worldview a little bit, and here's a great show I can watch. People versus O.J. Simpson, I thought was great. I love the documentary more, which I thought was one of the best docs that year. I don't know if you saw it. Wasn't that great? That could have went on forever. Even though as long as it was, I was like, this could keep going. I was enjoying that so much.
Well, sorry, you cut out there from, was that OJ Made in America?
The documentary one. Yeah. Yep. But this TV show was great. And, again, that cast really, really nailed it. Wormwood? I don't know anything about Wormwood.
Yeah, this was an Errol Morris documentary series, actually. He has a new one out coming out here soon about Timothy Leary. I think it's called My Psychedelic Love Story. But this is this really bizarre thing about some stuff that the CIA was involved in mid-century. And if you want to go down some weird conspiracy theory rabbit holes about stuff that the U.S. government might have been involved in at one time, this is the show for you.
Okay. Roots, of course, everyone's seen, well, I don't know if anyone, but most people have seen Roots by now. But the updated series as well. Up series, I'd never even heard of that until I saw this.
It's really great. You know, it's funny because they've released, what are they up to now? 63 Up and 56 Up or whatever. So anyway, this whole series started when these kids were 7 years old back in the 60s. And the idea is that a film is made about them every 7 years. So it's a documentary series about literally capturing people's lives, these people's lives. And you check in on them almost like old friends. What are they up to? What health problems have they had? What that they made, whatever. It's really interesting. It's like, you know, this is a real attempt at capturing the ebb and flow of a life in a cinematic form.
Okay. I like this next group, you know, these documentaries and reality TV shows. Mythbusters, of course, everyone likes Blown Away, and Weird Weekends, I think, is really great. I've seen some of that. I really like Kamu Bell. United States of America is a great show, and
this current season has been really, really incredible.
It's obviously important. You know, this sort of these subcultures that he explores is fantastic. So then we get to poor Anthony Bourdain. Yes.
Still, you know, one of my favorites. I mean, there's like, talk about something that I love to just like put on and watch if I just want to learn something or just escape from the news cycle or whatever. You know, just firing up an episode from his show on demand, especially from a CNN show, Parts Unknown, which I think is his apex.
It was, I remember like when that was on, it was appointment viewing for, you know, I think it was Sunday nights when they premiered, and we used to make sure we watched those shows. And again, for all the reasons everybody states, and you probably state in this book, it's has almost less to do about the cooking and more to do about where he is and the people he's talking to. And that was the hook, right? And that was the great part. And too bad he just couldn't keep it going. But 13th, obviously fantastic. Yeah. Night on Earth, I've seen. How the Universe Works, I've only seen a little bit of that because I watch a lot of documentaries on you know, theoretical and practical physics and stuff like that and astronomy. And so I haven't seen that, and that's just because it probably just got lumped in with a bunch of other things that I was like, I can't. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, there's just so much out there. I mean, it's like looking back on this again, it's like, wow, you know, even if I like, wow, still in quarantine here, you know, with my mom, I wanted to figure out something to watch. I have to say, though, one of the next things I really do want to show my mom is Long Way Round, which is on page. And I love this series so much. And, you know, I haven't seen the new one, actually, which just started with Ewan McGregor. It's called Long Way Up.
Yep.
On TV Plus now, restarts at Tierra del Fuego.
I've seen the advert for it. Yeah, I haven't seen it, though, yeah.
Goes all the way up South America through Central America until eventually reaches Los Angeles. But Long Way Round is one of my favorites. And it's really great to see you. And I guess this would be like between Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith, getting on a motorbike and traveling all the way across Europe and through Russia and the former Soviet republics and, you know, giving you this really amazing view on parts of the world that you just haven't seen, you know?
This sort of like getting on your motorcycle road trip obviously has such a romantic, you know, and especially to us Western culture because of Easy Rider. And I always think about, though, do you remember a movie that came out? I don't even remember when it came out now, a while ago. Motorcycle Diaries.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Che Guevara.
Yeah.
Exactly. Follows a young pre-violent. Yeah. Che Guevara on his sort of
Gael Garcia Bernal, yeah,
right. When he nobody really knew who he was, and that, you know, just to be able to go and experience things like that is such a romantic thing. So yeah, I the Long Way Round stuff always appealed to me for sure. Amazing Race, 31 seasons. I've never seen a single minute of it.
It's so funny. I just had like a horrifying moment recently where I forgot for a moment, like, oh wait, no, Mark Burnett didn't produce this, right? I was like, no, yes, thankfully he did not produce this. I can still watch it.
Didn't Conan O'Brien have something to do with that, or was that another one? I think he produced one of those types of shows. But anyways.
Yeah, I forgot about that. But you know, Amazing Race, I mean, it's kind of like a vision of the ugly American out in the world, essentially. I mean, being obnoxious to people in other countries and everything. But at the same time, it's like, it's also a really lovely vision of the world because everyone, these, you know, American travelers meet. And I think there is a Canadian edition as well.
There is, yep. Yep.
Everyone they meet, you know, are so nice. And, you know, it's a vision of the world as being opening and embracing. And like, it is ultimately a great endorsement of travel. And I think anything that's an endorsement of travel means that it's an endorsement of expanding your horizons and learning something new and being more empathetic to your fellow man. So I'm all for that.
Absolutely. The of course, the Planet series, you know, the Attenborough, those are, if, you know, I think God, everyone's seen those by now. I know that I watched them on repeat too, especially the, I remember waiting for the Blue Planet one. And then, the Our Planet from last year was, I think it was episode five, the jungle one, unbelievable. And, you know, this show gets better and better because the technology gets better and better, yeah. Right? The stuff they're able to do with the frames per second now and the clarity and the colors is just some of the shots they get. You just can't, you almost can't even believe it, but, those are so great. Yeah. Toys That Made Us is a fun, that's a really fun one. I really like that one. I love, we've had plenty of arguments at work about that and what should be, what should be included and what shouldn't. And that's a really fun one. Masters of Sex, great show. Fantastic show. Water Margin, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, this was a Japanese series from the 70s. And, you know, it's based on this great, you know, canonical Japanese novel. And it's an epic, you know, martial arts extravaganza. It's, you know, it is epic storytelling that unfolds, you know, over a very long period of time, kind of like the epic miniseries that were in the US in the 70s and 80s, you know, mm-hmm. all these characters in very intense situations. It's really interesting.
Documentary Now is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Who Do You Think You Are is fantastic. I really like the, like I've seen all these two moguls and movie stars, story of film, anything film related, documentary style I've seen for sure. Of course, they're always great. I love that you put Jeopardy on here. And I also love that you put like the winning streaks. Because Ken Jennings, I love when they did the Super Jeopardy there earlier. Was it this year?
It was this year. Yeah. I can believe it. I know. Yeah. I love that so much.
And I'm very happy with the results because we all know who the villain is in that.
Yes.
These are all, all The Wire. I mean, it's funny how The Wire didn't, did you have to fight for that one? Because it should have showed up probably in one of the other ones, but it's, you know.
No, you know.
Widely considered the greatest TV show of all time.
I felt it was appropriate to put here as well, because I think you can learn so much about how institutions fail people.
Okay.
From this series. Which is a message that really is as timely now as ever.
Making a Murderer, kind of a funny choice. It just seems so, to me, sort of National Enquirer type stuff.
A level of television,
right? So,
I generally agree.
Yeah, but I mean, it's sort of just like the zeitgeist surrounding that was, I mean, it was huge. You couldn't go anywhere without hearing about it. There's no doubt it had an impact on people. Surviving R. Kelly, of course, and a loudest voice. I missed this the first flip through. I love that you put 30 for 30 in here, because although I don't watch sports, I freaking love sports documentaries. Yeah. It's a weird thing, but they're all great. I don't even know how many there is now.
Because a ton. And I keep releasing new ones all the time. It's pretty incredible to think that this just was initially going to be 30 documentaries to celebrate.
Right.
30th anniversary, but it's become such a brand. And even this year they had some really good new ones. Like there was Be Water about Bruce Lee, which was excellent. And
the Bruce Lee one, I thought I'd just seen documentaries on Bruce Lee before, so I thought, what was the one this year that I really did like, though? What were the ones they've done? They've done Lance Armstrong, they've done Bruce Lee. What was the one they did earlier in the year that was really good?
It wasn't 30 for 30, but it was The Last Dance.
Last Dance was good. But it wasn't Last Dance. 30 for 30 did one, because I remember talking at work about how much I enjoyed it. Did they not do one on the steroids in baseball or the home run chase?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Mark McGuire and I enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
Ken Burns Baseball. Love it. I love, especially the early seasons, the first few innings where they look at the early 1900s. Fantastic.
That's so interesting.
Isn't it so great? It's just unbelievable what the game was back then and how to
fight. How it evolved and how it really was kind of like a folk sport in a way, you know,
before women weren't allowed to go at first. And the reason the first baseball cards were found in cigarette packs, because that's just because everybody smoked, and just the gambling aspect, of course, and you know, which led to the Black Sox thing, and really fast the story, baseball or not, the stories and the characters are just it was just a different, just such a different time. So this is there's a guy, you like, how many are in here that you put in? There's a ton.
I think we have 95. Yeah, I think I had 95.
Anything then, like, was that, what did they say? You just put as many as you want or try and keep it under 100? What was the?
I had 95. So they gave me a list of 95 suggestions. And then I did go through and, I mean, most of these really, I mean, looking at it again, are really ones that I ended up swapping in with my own stuff.
Oh, right on.
You know, I mean, I had to get, I mean, something like Martin Scorsese's The Blues, like,
right.
That's something like, I had those DVDs out from Netflix back when we still did that for so long. It became like a running joke about how I had those DVDs out forever, but I love that show.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I already told you about how I love Now Hear This, which is on weekly right now. Yeah, I mean, so like stuff that, you know, I try to put in as much, you know, as much of my own favorites in here as possible. And that's a great thing about working with DK. If you make a compelling argument enough to do that, you can really do that. I mean, there are some things here that I had not seen before, actually, that then I did watch. Like, I'd never seen Alias Grace, about an interesting early bit of Canadian history. But I found that to be really fascinating, I have to say, about life in... What was it? I guess upper Canada in the early 1840s, when it was like before it was even called Ontario. That was super interesting. And yeah, so I mean this, but all of this had to be written in a very compressed period of time, and it was pretty intense. But now it's like, wow, when I wrote all of this, it was before the pandemic, and now it's like, this is so perfect that there's a book like this, that because people shut in, you know, really want to find things to watch, you know, more than ever.
Yeah. Like I said, this is a great, you know, pull book, right? It's going to sit on your shelf, or even, it's a great coffee table book too. I mean, Like it's just going to create so much conversation and discussion, and, you know, people are, I assume people will do exactly what I did. They'll go right to the index and look for their favorite shows. And
yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's like, you know, you and I could sit down and list, you know, hundreds of shows that you're just obviously going to be in. You don't need to be an authority on anything to know that, you know, Sopranos is going to be in this book somewhere or whatever, right? Like, there's some obvious ones, but the great thing about it is, looking through it, is there's some not obvious ones, and there's ones I've never heard of, and there's ones that, you know, it's fantastic. Was there anything that you wanted that they said, oh no, we're saving that one for another category?
No, I don't think so.
No, okay.
No, I think, I mean, working with DK is always a dream. You know, they're so easy to work with, and
right. But in 1,000 shows, there's bound to be, you know, some. There must have been some. Maybe not with your category, but I'm sure there was some fighting over some of the other ones. I mean,
I wonder. I mean, that's the interesting thing, because
a good show, you can pull so many different things from. Obviously, right. You can learn from it. You're entertained by it. You can cry from it. You can get scared from it. I mean, you know, it's You could make an argument that. Just looking here, that you know, maybe True Detective, you know, could teach you about detective work, how the police work. You know, that could be some, you know, could have been in your category, or that could be, you know, depending on how they want to play it. But yeah, that's the thing. There's so many. A good show, you know, should leave you feeling complete in a way.
Yeah, most definitely. I don't really know what the process was like for any of the other authors. I can't really speak for them at all. I haven't interacted or met them or emails with them or anything.
Sure.
Our own little remit, and that was that. But I no matter what, though, it turned out really well, because I mean, to think that this was just, you know, only being assigned at the start of this year, and now is complete, and I'm looking at it right now. It's pretty amazing.
Well, this is great. So it screams, you know, updated new edition for sure. At some point, you know, they can update it with shows that have even come out, you know, later this year and then going forward. So they'll have to get you back for volume 2, whenever that happens to be. So what not to watch. What to watch when 1,000 TV shows for every mood and moment comes out November 10th, wherever books are sold. Indie stores need your help more than ever now, so I recommend you guys seek out your local independent store, whether it be online or not.
Most definitely.
But if you live in an area that rural or not, that doesn't have those types of things, and then seek the internet and you shall find. This is a great book, and I really think it's going to do well. Christian, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. Any parting shots?
Steve, you know, such a pleasure talking to you always. Guess I'd just say, you know, for your listeners, you know, stay safe, you know, keep on being vigilant in these scary times. It's so important that we don't let our guard down and still take the pandemic as seriously as possible. And for you listeners in the U.S., please vote. We're 11 days away now.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Yes, please do. And I'll just to, you know, reinforce that, it's more important than ever. Christian, I love you. I can't thank you enough. Enjoy your weekend.
There you have it, another episode of Everything's Canon All Wrapped Up. A huge thanks to my good friend Christian for stopping by and taking the time to talk about this really fun new book. It really is the perfect coffee table book that I'm sure will delight you and your friends as you sit around discussing your favorite shows and even discover a great many new ones. What to Watch When 1000 TV Shows for Every Mood and Moment is out now, so please grab a copy wherever you buy your books. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please be safe out there. Bye for now. I turn this gun, it's time to go now.